Hi everyone, I'm your host NG, and welcome to the 58th episode of the podcast, Sounds About Right, Audiobooks Help Us Understand the World. And on this episode, I was joined by Lewis Dartnell, author of the book Being Human, How Our Biology Shaped World History. And in the book, Lewis tells our story through the lens of this uniquely fragile nature for the first time, from cognitive biases to endemic diseases. He explores how human biology has shaped relationships, societies, economics, and wars across the globe, and considers how, importantly, it continues to challenge and define our progress. It was great discussing the book with Lewis, and I hope you enjoy the episode. This book is a third out of a trilogy. How does this one follow the first two?
Yeah, so in my mind at least, when I was researching and writing this new book, Being Human, it was the third in a sort of a triptych or a trilogy of books. Although I feel I should quickly point out, you don't need to have read the other books, you don't need to read them in any particular order, but they're still sort of linked in a way. And the first book was called The Knowledge, How to Rebuild a World from Scratch. And it takes the sort of conceit or the premise that there's been some kind of apocalypse and civilizations collapsed and the vast majority of the human race has died out, and you're part of a community of survivors who are trying to work out how to go around rebuilding and recovering everything and how you could reboot civilization as quickly as possible. So what are the most important scientific discoveries and technological inventions hiding behind the scenes in the modern world, all the stuff we sort of take for granted? So that book is really a story about human ingenuity and resourcefulness and creativity and how we built our own modern world. And then the second book, Origins, is all about how different features of the planet itself that we live on, features of planet Earth, from plate tectonics to continental drift or the circulation of the atmosphere high above our heads, or where different metal ores or other natural resources are found, and how those geological and planetary forces have had a defining influence on the course of human history, and again, the shaping of the world we find ourselves in today. And so what I want to do for this new book, for Being Human, was keep that same kind of like investigative spirit, looking at our modern world, holding up a mirror to it to show why things we take for granted or things that seem commonplace or usual are actually pretty strange and sort of quirky, and explain them, explain what's the basis behind them. And in this particular book, looking at features of us, ourselves, intrinsic features of us as an animal species, of our humanness, from aspects of our genetics to our anatomy and physiology to our psychology and weird quirks in our sort of processing system and in our cognitive biases, and look at how those aspects of us, aspects of our own humanity, have been deeply influential in the playing out of history. So that's what I was thinking about. That's what was in the back of my mind as I was writing Being Human.
And so with that being said, how did you come up with the decision on picking the specific chapters that you wanted to write about in the book?
Yeah, so I did a whole lot of research, and most of my books have taken 2 or 3 years to research and write. And it's all a case of reading loads around the subject, talking to lots of different people to find the most interesting stories and examples that I wanted to explore, and then knitting them together into a narrative, into the book. And so the different chapters in Being Human look at different facets or different aspects of us. So there's a chapter about particularly mutations in our DNA and in our genetics. There's another chapter about our psychology and these cognitive biases, these sort of psychological glitches in how we think and how we process. There's other examples about how we evolved to be much more sort of peaceful with each other and how we grew to be able to cooperate together very, very effectively, which is one of the prerequisite technologies, if you like, to found civilization in the first place. You know, cities and civilizations are no more than huge collectors of people working together in the same direction in this sort of big collaborative project.
In in the chapters, you highlight specific aspects and its consequences through history. And I'd like to touch on the chapter titled Family. How did we, through evolution, come up with pair bonding, and what did it help solve, Lewis?
Yeah, so throughout the book, I try to begin by rooting in something deep and fundamental about ourselves, seeing how that played out in our evolution, and then what the consequences of that through history were. And in one of these early chapters on family, I explain why this concept of the human family is in fact something that's quite unusual in the animal kingdom. And during our evolution, in our evolutionary lineage over the last, you know, millions of years since we diverged from our common ancestor with the chimpanzees, two major things were happening in hominin evolution and human evolution. We were becoming bipedal, able to walk upright on two legs, but at the same time, we were developing to be much more intelligent, to have bigger brains, and that gave us our capabilities for tool use and inventing technologies, being able to communicate and use language and cooperate together. But the problem in terms of the evolution is that being bipedal and being big-brained, they're sort of at loggerheads with each other. They're mutually exclusive. The adaptations, the changes to the human pelvis that are needed to be able to walk upright and be bipedal constrain the hole in the middle of the pelvis, the birth canal that the baby's skull and its brain has to be born through. So we became limited in how intelligent we could become by the fact that we were evolving to be bipedal at the same time. And the solution that was hit upon by evolution was biparental investment, that humans developed to continue developing long after they've emerged from the womb. So for several years after being a newborn and an infant, we're entirely dependent, entirely vulnerable, and need help with being fed and moving around and being protected. And it reached the point where the mother alone was no longer able to raise or rear a human child like most other animal species do. It mostly falls to the mother. And in humans, the father was needed as well to help devote time and resources in rearing their children. And that's where biparental investment comes in. But for biparental investment to work, you need to have a kind of biological contract that the woman, the mother, has to be sure that the father is going to stick around and, in fact, devote those resources and times to helping raise the children rather than just buggering off. And on his own part, the father has to be confident in the relationship and that he is, in fact, the father of that child and it's not somebody else's. And this is the concept of pair bonding, that the mother and father become tied together by a hormonal link, by a pair bond that's mediated by the hormone oxytocin. And oxytocin is used for lots of different things in mammalian reproduction. It triggers the contraction of the womb when it comes to childbirth. It stimulates milk production for lactation. It forms the tight bond between the mother and her offspring, which is common to many other mammal species. But in humans and another pair bonding species, that oxytocin bond was also extended between the mother and the father, and then between both those parents and the children. That's what forms the sort of nucleus in the center of human relations, is that human family, the parents and their direct children.
Interestingly enough, I got from your book that pair bonding lasts between 4 to 6 years. Is that a coincidence with divorce rates, or is there something in that, would you say, Lewis?
Yeah, so as far as natural selection and evolution is concerned, that pair bond, that tightly forged link between mother and father, only needs to last long enough for each child to go through that vulnerable developmental stage until they are largely self-dependent, or certainly less vulnerable and less dependent. And so that would take sort of 4 or 5 years. There's no exact cutoff on it. And so perhaps it's not a coincidence that our feeling of romantic love, which is the sensation we get from that oxytocin pair bonding, starts to fade and not, in some cases, disappear completely after a couple of years. And so maybe that is tied to divorce rates and what some people have called the 7-year itch. So perhaps on a slightly longer time scale, that pair bonding starts fading and dissolving away. And ultimately, the two people don't feel the love for each other that they did previously. And the marriage dissolves and people file divorce. Because when you think about it, marriage is no more than a sort of cultural practice or cultural institution built on top of that biological foundation of pair bonding. It's a public declaration that these two people are going to stay together for the foreseeable future and be committed to each other. That's the sort of expression of that biological contract that we talked about earlier.
Mm. And I mean, I even learned from your book about the ethnographic survey of over 800 cultures, which found 83% of them were polygamous. Is there a reason why polygamy makes sense in some cultures than others, Lewis?
Yeah, so monogamy, so the pairing or the marriage between one man and one woman in sort of traditional terms, is something of a cultural oddity to the sort of the Western world, to ancient Greece and then Rome and then Europe, which then spread around the world with the age of exploration and, you know, colonization and empire building and exploitation and, you know, a lot of the less savory aspects of the age of exploration, what Europe forced upon the rest of the world. We effectively exported this cultural practice of monogamy. But when you are working as an ethnographer or an anthropologist, it is actually an oddity. Like many, many cultures around the world are polygynous and in the sense that they practice one man marrying several women at the same time. And this, again, when you look at the biology, can make a lot of sense, particularly when you've got agriculture and civilization. Once that sort of threshold has been passed in history, rather than a hunter-gatherer society, because you then get the concept of the accumulation of resources and the concept of wealth, and therefore some men can be much more wealthy than other men, have a lot more resources, and are therefore able to support several wives and children from several wives. So there's a lot of sort of anthropology going on behind the scenes there as well.
You dedicated two chapters discussing diseases throughout history. What are some of the links between diseases and how it's changed the world?
Yeah, so in Being Human, I separate between endemic diseases, diseases which are sort of settled in to a particular region, a particular area, and often bubble away in the background and may kill a lot of children. But if you've survived to an adult, you end up having a certain degree of resistance to those endemic diseases. And those endemic diseases tend to have different historical effects to pandemics or when a disease breaks into a new population, which is on the whole very vulnerable, and the disease spreads very quickly and suddenly kills a large number of people. I'm going to look at different examples of both, but within pandemics, there have been quite well-known historical episodes such as the Black Death, the bubonic plague across Europe and Asia, which suddenly killed huge fractions of the population. And historians have made the arguments that within Northern Europe, and particularly in England, that sudden death shifted the sort of social landscape and ended up loosening the ties that were holding together the feudal system. And a move from less of a system of feudalism and the lord of the manor owning all the land and serfs working on it to more of a sort of capitalist, the very early stages of capitalism, where money becomes the medium of exchange, that people buy land or rent it off the landowners and pay for different services rather than sort of demand labor or the people living on the land having to answer the call to arms when the king declares war against France or whatever. So there seems to be this long-lasting cultural and then societal shift after the Black Death. And there was another story that I found really interesting, again, from a sort of a British perspective, which was when Scotland was looking to get involved in the sort of mercantile trade, which was making England quite wealthy at the time. And the Scots tried to found a colony on Panama so they could integrate themselves into all the trade going around the Caribbean. And their grand plan was to have either some kind of road across the narrow sinew of land, which is the Panama Isthmus between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and therefore join trade across these two great oceans of the earth, or possibly even be able to dig some kind of canal so ships could go through directly. But this grand plan became scuppered by endemic diseases in this tropical region. So diseases like yellow fever and malaria, which are made it across from Africa, probably in the early stages of the transatlantic slave trade. And the colony failed. Huge numbers of people died on that Scottish colony and ended up failing. And the sort of economic backlash of that left Scotland very financially unstable. And the argument is it then was willing to consider a political union with its stronger neighbour to the south, with England. So the political union of Scotland and England, which then gave birth to Great Britain, the United Kingdom, had as a direct influence playing into that endemic diseases, tropical diseases on the other side of the world when Scotland was trying to establish its own colony.
Absolutely. In fact, that was something I wanted to mention as well. So I'm glad you did. I found that very, very interesting. And just also, diseases played a part in ending the First World War as well, didn't it, Lewis?
Well, this is slightly more controversial. But what certainly did happen in the end stages of the First World War was one of the largest pandemics in recent history. And by some counts is perhaps even more significant than the bubonic plague and the Black Death. And it certainly killed more people, but there were more people around in the 1900s than there were in the 1300s of the Black Death. And this is the influenza epidemic, the pandemic. It's sometimes called the Spanish flu, perhaps slightly unfairly because it didn't originate in Spain. But some historians have argued that this pandemic ripping through the trenches and the front lines shifted the balance of power and may have caused Germany to lose the war, although it seems likely that it was heading that way anyway, or perhaps more likely it hastened the end of the First World War. It brought about an early conclusion and therefore may have fed into the sort of negotiations and the peace treaties afterwards, and therefore the, you know, sort of political landscape that emerged out of the First World War. But what's curious about this Spanish influenza that it killed millions upon millions of people around the world, more so than the First World War, and possibly even more so than the First World and Second World War put together. But it's often only really discussed as a footnote to the First World War itself. And yet it was this huge biological event alongside this global warfare of the First World War.
Taking a bit of a detour here, but why has agriculture been described as the worst mistake in human history?
So this isn't necessarily an opinion that I would agree with myself, but the argument's been made by people like Jared Diamond and others is that as populations of humanity transitioned from being hunter-gatherers into agriculturalists, so farming their own crops and rearing their own livestock, we settled down into more and more dense populations and also came into very close contact with a lot of animal species. And that creates the perfect conditions for diseases to jump the species barrier, to transfer from things like goats or sheep or cows or the other animals we keep into the human population and then spread very quickly through the dense human populations. And that was coupled with other problems of agriculture, such as a more limited nutrient intake. So we weren't often as healthy as hunter-gatherer societies are. And so for those reasons, some historians, some anthropologists have claimed agriculture was one of the worst inventions or one of the worst ideas that humanity ever came up with. But of course, it's also a prerequisite for cities and civilization as we know it. So it certainly has had some negative impacts. But I, for one, quite like my mod cons and living in a nice house and having a lot of things provided for me by society and by a complex civilization. And I don't think I'd like to go back to it to a hunter-gatherer existence myself.
You and me both. So you have a chapter that focuses on cognitive bias. What are the kinds of cognitive biases that exist? And why is knowing about them still not enough for it to, for lack of a better term, leave us?
But after the last couple of decades, there's been a lot of research amongst psychologists as well as economists looking into whether humans always make perfectly rational or self-serving decisions, or if we deviate from what you might expect from pure rationality and make sort of what might be described as being an irrational or slightly silly decision. And these whole slew of different biases in our behavior or cognitive biases have come to light. And one of these I talk about in the book afflicted, I argue, Columbus back in the late 15th century when he was looking for a sea passage to India and China to capitalize on all the trade that he thought he could take by heading out west from Europe rather than across the overland routes like the Silk Road by heading east. And so convinced was he was so sure in his prior beliefs and his prior conception that he had in fact reached the Orient, he'd reached the East, that he simply ignored all of the evidence that mounted up very clearly in retrospect that he hadn't reached China or India at all. He'd reached some strange new place that was completely unexpected. And it became known as the New World. We call it the Americas. But Columbus went to his deathbed, never accepting that he discovered a strange new place. And he ignored the evidence that went against his prior beliefs and sort of cherry-picked the few bits and pieces that did support his belief. So this is known as a confirmation bias. And confirmation bias has played a huge role through history. Leading up to a more recent example was in the dodgy dossier that was assembled as the evidence that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and led to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And it very rapidly became apparent that Saddam Hussein in Iraq had not been developing weapons of mass destruction. And the report that was written to sort of analyze what had gone wrong in this intelligence community beforehand leading up to the war concluded that basically confirmation bias had played a huge role, that the analysts assembling this body of evidence had ignored all the evidence that ran contrary to their prior belief and cherry-picked the examples that supported it. And it's confirmation biases like these that have not just had a huge influence on human history across the centuries and the millennia, but will also have a huge role to play in how we face our future. And a lot of cognitive biases feed into how we will deal with long-term but severe challenges such as climate change, in terms of whether people accept that climate change is happening at all, or if it's due to human activity or supposedly part of natural cycles. And it affects how we choose to change our lifestyles to make the kind of modifications that we know we need to make to use fewer resources, to have less of a heavy footprint on the natural world around us. So cognitive biases are playing a very profound role still today.
Would you say, well, let me not put any words in your mouth, but when I listened to that part of the audiobook, I thought just even when it comes to social media, there's the chance of confirmation bias because it's going to reinforce a lot of things that you already believe and show things that you already confirm things that you already believe as opposed to opposing opinions. And further beyond that, not to get onto them at all, but American news as well can be quite partisan in terms of
polarized. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Quite polarizing in terms of the confirmation bias. So even in that aspect, the kind of media that we consume, is it fair to say that moving forward in the future, it can affect our confirmation bias as well?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that, NG, that the very structure, the very way that social media is set up with platforms like Facebook or TikTok or Twitter or whatever is where you curate it yourself. You choose who you want to follow. And it, quite naturally, people tend to follow people that are interesting to them or have similar points of view or opinions to them. And so more and more of us are living in this echo chamber. We're getting our news from social media. We're forming our own opinions and getting an idea of what might be the prevalent point of view through social media, but by this very echo chamber that we've created and constructed around ourselves. And even if you try to push beyond that echo chamber and let's say do a Google search for information, the algorithms behind a lot of these search engines are operating the same way. It notices what you clicked on previously and what searches you've done in the past, and it tries to feed you things that it thinks you will find interesting. So again, it's just feeding back into that confirmation bias. So even if you're trying hard to expose yourself to new sources of information and new opinions, the algorithms behind a lot of these social media platforms and search engines, as well as our very psychologies, are working against us and that. And that's one of the main drivers behind the increasing polarization of news outlets and political system in the US, but also in Britain and in Europe and around the world as well.
You also mentioned the sunk cost fallacy within the chapter as well. What is it within us that makes it difficult for us to cut our losses when we can clearly see that something is not working?
Yeah, it's curious, isn't it? And there's a classic example of the sunk cost fallacy, which is once you've committed to course of action or you've invested time or resources, energy in something, even as it starts becoming apparent that you should cut your losses, abandon that effort and try something else, we continue hacking away at it. We want to, you know, make good for the investment that we've already committed. And then the classical example of this I talk about was the Concorde development in France and Britain. So much so that the sunk cost fallacy is often also called the Concorde fallacy. And it became clear that it was technologically far harder than they thought it was, that it was going to be, that the market for supersonic passenger aircraft had basically fallen, the bottom fallen out of it once America outlawed supersonic and therefore sonic boom flights over the American mainland. So about the only routes they could fly were across the Atlantic. So there weren't many routes they could fly. The aircraft became really expensive. The maintenance of them became really expensive. And looking back on it, you know, with 2020 hindsight and perfect rationality now, that project should have been abandoned halfway through when it became clear that it wasn't going to be a commercial success, but they continued through with it. And we see a lot of that sort of same sunk cost reasoning or sunk cost fallacy in a lot of things we do, whether that's the investments we make, maybe relationships we keep at, even when it's clear that it hasn't got a long-term future anymore. We end up being quite conservative and stick with the status quo rather than taking the leap and risking something new or something different.
Okay, lastly, what perspective of yours has changed whilst you're putting this book together or even throughout the process of the trilogy?
Yeah, so one of the things that stood out to me when I was researching and writing this most recent book, Being Human, actually were these cognitive biases. And I was, you know, was aware of them in the past, but it really opened my eyes when I dug right down into them when I was researching and writing that particular chapter. And one of the most surprising things about these cognitive biases is that even if you are aware of their existence, even if you are, you know, one of the world's top professors, which I'm not, but one of the world's top professors researching into cognitive biases, you are still vulnerable to them. There's something so deep and innate about them in sort of depths of our psychology and our cognitive processing that actually it's very hard to avoid them or get around them. And there is a lot of research going into that now about sort of de-biasing our decision-making processes, whether doing that as an individual or in committees or selection panels. And, you know, some solutions have arisen, but they're not always perfectly efficient or perfectly successful. So it's curious that this ancient parts of the way we process and we think are, even in the modern world, even with all the research that's gone into it, still quite hard to sort of circumvent and circumnavigate.
Brilliant. Thank you, Lewis.
Thank you, NG. I've really enjoyed this chat. It's been a lot of fun.
Same. Honestly, I could have spoken about so many different chapters of the book as well, but I had to try and keep it as succinct as possible. But
a real joy to listen to. What was your favourite bit? Chapter did you find most surprising or most interesting?
I liked the chapter about... See, I didn't even mention it, but the one about just alcohol and tobacco
and how we hack our own brains
how it hacks our brains. That chapter blew my mind, and it was such an interesting chapter that if I was to mention it now, I'd spend the whole half an hour talking about it.
So. Well, maybe we should leave that as a hook for your listeners. If you want to learn about how we as intelligent conscious beings throughout history have sought out ways of changing our minds, of affecting how our very brains work with things like caffeine or nicotine or opium, listen to the audiobook of Being Human or pick up a copy from your bookshop. There's your clickbait. There's your teaser.
Brilliant. Thanks, Lewis.
Cheers, Angie. Right. Thanks very much.